This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. A bomb threat is never an inconsequential thing, but 16 in one day is inconceivable. Well, that's what David Posner of the JCC wrote earlier this month in an op-ed which was published in the Jewish news website Heritage. Posner went on to say that although the threats were a hoax, they were, quote, designed to create a kind of disruptive terror in places that serve as visible community hubs of activity. And he said JCCs are now spending more time and money on security. Since then, there have been more bomb threats, 27 at Jewish centres in 17 states on a single day last week. The FBI is investigating the threats. Well, joining me to talk about the threats and the response is Rabbi Hillel Skolnick. He's the rabbi with the Southwest Orlando Jewish Congregation. He's also president of the Greater Orlando Board of Rabbis. Thanks so much for joining me, Rabbi.
Thank you for having me back.
And Jim Shipley, columnist with Heritage, Florida Jewish News. Thank you so much for coming in, Jim.
Thank you, Matthew.
Jim, let me start with you. Threats have been made to JCCs and synagogues before, so what's different about this wave of threats?
I think the only thing, two things that are different. Number one, the volume was a little heavier. And second of all, because of conditions in the country, I think the media became more aware of it.
So how do you write about it without amplifying the threat?
It's difficult because, as you probably know right now, these threats, at least in Orlando, are still under investigation by the police department.
Do you see it as kind of a straight-ahead criminal investigation, though, or is there something else going on here?
It's hard to tell because we live in a country right now where there is a lot of heightened anxiety and, as you know, a lot of divisions. It usually turns out that these kinds of things, if there's one semi-serious call and the media picks it up, immediately you're going to get a ton more of people who just like to engage in hoaxes.
Mm-hmm. So the kind of copycat threats.
It's a copycat threat, and there are certain obvious targets of this kind of thing. I'm sure the Sentinel gets them all the time. Usually synagogues get some. Mm-hmm. Jewish community centers get some. It's just that kind of activity.
So is it something that you've been wrestling with how to address it as a columnist?
Yes, and frankly hesitating mm-hmm. about it because it is so easy to take a look at what goes on in the media today. As a matter of fact, I heard an expression yesterday I never heard in my life, alternate facts. And I think that's a very dangerous expression to begin with, and that's another reason I'm hesitant in my own to write about such a thing because you don't want to emphasize it too much. You don't want to expand the fact that somebody might think this is a great idea and, again, make a call or a threat or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. Rabbi Hillel Skolnick, let me bring you into the conversation. Why do you think Jewish centers are being targeted at this time?
I think that there is an increased feeling of ability for people to express hatred that they have in their hearts. And people feel empowered in this day, at this time, to show that hatred outwardly and to do things that are meant to cause fear in our society and fear within the people who are members of the Jewish faith. And I think, unfortunately, on a certain level, it's working. You find parents who are questioning whether or not to send their kids to preschool at JCCs across the country. Here in Orlando at our JCC in Maitland, there has been a threat 3 weeks in a row, every Wednesday. And I can only imagine what people are thinking coming up to Wednesday, saying, what's going to happen tomorrow? Is there going to be another threat? Should I send my kids to school? Should I not? Is it worth it if I'm just going to have to go and pick them up? And in that way, the idea of trying to instill fear in people is working. And people feel emboldened in our society to take these feelings of hatred that they have and put them into action. And that's, for me, the big problem, is that people are doing things about it, and then we need to try and figure out where the feelings of hatred are coming from and try and bridge that to a feeling of understanding and mutual respect that we all need to have for one another.
Rabbi, why do you think people feel emboldened, as you say, to express some hatred that they have, whatever it may be?
I think they look around and they see that people who are front and center in our society have no hesitancy to express hatred openly and willingly. And they look and they say, if these people can do it and not be reproached or not suffer any kind of consequence, then what's to stop me from doing it too? And it legitimizes those feelings. And far be it for me to tell a person how to feel, but there is something to be said for taking a feeling that you have and having the sensibility to understand that, A, it may be a correct or appropriate feeling, or B, there are some feelings that we have that we don't act upon. Sometimes I feel frustrated, but that doesn't mean I go and act with my frustration. You take a deep breath and you move on. And people are seeing leaders of our society not understanding what it means to take a deep breath and to move on to something more important.
Okay, so I wonder, Jim Shipley, if you could just talk a little bit about the importance and the significance of the Jewish Community Center. They've been around for a long time. How critical, how central are they to Jewish identity in America?
Well, that opens a wide subject. I'll see if I can precise it for you. When the Romans came and took most of the Jews out of Israel over 2,000 years ago, and we scattered to some 50 other countries, we invented something very unique in society, the portable community. We didn't have a big temple anymore, so we invented a thing called the synagogue. We didn't have our social organization as they did in our country, so we formed JCCs and Jewish family organizations and things like that, so that the Federation and the day school and synagogues become the center of our community, even though we may be scattered not all in one area. And that is the way the Jewish communities operate today. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a center for it, and the one that gets the publicity is usually either a synagogue, a group of synagogues, or if there is a federation in the community, it's the federation because they get the publicity, they have the day school, that's where the kids are, and that's where they can strike the most fear.
Can I just add that the Hebrew term for synagogue is Beit Knesset, which means house of gathering.
And that's what it is. That's where the community is.
So this is kind of striking at the heart of the community. I'm sure, Rabbi, you could back that up too.
Absolutely. I think that it's not only our community, it's striking at the hearts of communities, unfortunately, around the country. But it's also an opportunity for the Jewish community here and in other parts of the country to stand up and say, we're not going to sit by and live in fear. We're going to declare our right of freedom of religion that we enjoy in this country, that we are allowed to express ourselves as Jews and as members of the Jewish people. And we should be able to do so without fear of hatred and fear of someone threatening our way of life. Mm-hmm. And in that way, the Jewish community here in Orlando is extraordinarily grateful to the Orange County Sheriff's Office, to the Orlando Police Department, to the FBI offices here in the incredible amount of support and interaction and cooperation that they've offered in trying to figure out who is behind these threats and bringing them to a close and bringing them to a stop. But I think it's not a moment to be afraid. It's a moment to stand up and say, I'm not going to be afraid. You're not going to intimidate me. You're not going to prevent me from showing myself to be a proud person and member of whatever faith it is, and a person who's proud to send my children to whatever preschool I choose to send them to. That is going to be my own decision, which I do based on my own factors, not on whether someone is trying to instill fear out there in society.
Let me just read something that I read on the Jewish parenting website, Kavella. This is from Jordana Horn. She urged parents not to be afraid. Here's what she wrote, quote, bomb threats. Well, let me tell you something. I go to the JCC near me for music classes. My nephews have gone there for nursery school. My son will go there to participate in the sports team. My parents go there for art classes, and we won't stop. Do you get the sense, Rabbi, that that's a commonly held view? Or as Alyssa Strauss wrote on Slate, she wrote, I envy Horn's boldness, but I can't help but be afraid. What are you hearing from your congregation? Are there kind of two competing instincts here?
I think they very much are competing, and far be it for me to judge whoever it is that has either side. As a parent of young children, believe me, I completely not only understand but agree with the idea of doing absolutely everything that you feel you want to do and must do to keep your children safe. And I hold that idea paramount in my own life. But I also understand the idea of not living life in fear, that it's dangerous to simply walk out the door in the morning and to not go ahead and live the life that you want to lead is allowing those who are trying to make you afraid, it's allowing them to win. So there's absolutely the competing fear, and I think that there have been families who have left the Maitland JCC because of these repeated threats. The fear is real. The emotion is out there. Mm-hmm. But again, I say I understand it because I want my children to be safe, and I want everyone else's children to be safe. But more so, I want everyone in the country's children to be safe and to be able to send their children to whatever school they want to go to and not be afraid of some recurring threat. It's not the way that our society was meant to be.
Is it something that you talk to your congregation about?
Absolutely. And we have conversations about security in general on an ongoing basis. And people come to ask me about this all the time. And that's exactly what I tell them. I say, at the end of the day, when it comes to your own personal safety and security and that of the members of your family, especially your children, the decision is yours. You should do exactly what makes you feel safe. And that leads you to make a decision that is contrary to the greater needs of the Jewish community or a JCC or a synagogue, then I understand that. But I also always promote the idea of standing up to hatred and that we can't allow the other side to win in this endeavor of trying to make us afraid to be the people who we are. Mm-hmm. And the way that you don't allow the other side to win is, even in your moments of fear, to still find a way to walk into that door, to appreciate the increased security that you find at the JCC in Maitland and the JCC down here in Southwest Orlando, the Rosen JCC, at our synagogue, at other synagogues in Orlando and synagogues across the country, to say, thank you for doing everything that you can to make my family feel safe. I want to be a part of your community and will continue to be a part of your community.
You know, we are some 70 years out from the Holocaust, and there is an expression in Jewish life saying, never again. My son, who was in the Israeli army, when he graduated from his special forces class, he did it by parachute. And they landed, they all held up the Torah, our Bible, and said, never again. It meant never again because of Masada, where 900 Jewish souls committed suicide rather than being captured by the Romans. It means never again, that there will never be a Holocaust again. And what the rabbi is saying is so true. We stand as a community, and we stand strong. And as always, there will be those who say, I don't want to do that. I want to care for my own. And I too, Rabbi, understand that completely. But as Jews, we have to stand for what we are. We have been known too many times as the other. You referred to an attitude in the country now, and you're absolutely right. We have great divisions, and we have people in positions of power who don't seem to care about disabilities, ethnicity, or anything like that. And so, therefore, those who live in dark holes feel it's safe to come out and express themselves. And the only thing we can do is stand up against that, say never again. And yes, each individual family has to make their own decision. But somewhere we have to absolutely have the backbone to stand up and say never again.
David Posner in his column made comparisons between these threats and the kind of threats leveled at the Muslim community in the United States. Do you see that parallel too?
Absolutely on target, I say. As soon as these people can think of the other, and I understand that in this country there is a great frustration among many people. The dream is gone. Look, in 2007, a lot of people saw their dreams wiped out. Young people who their father was striving for the corner office, and all of a sudden, there was no more corner office. Houses were lost. We have come out of a terrific recession, but also a depression of minds. And coming out of that, many people feel left out. And when they do, they look for somebody to blame. And it's always going to be, quote, the other. It's Muslims, it's Jews, it's foreigners of any kind, it's people of a different color. There's always going to be another.
Rabbi, Do you want to hear or are you hearing expressions of support from other faith leaders and other religious communities?
I am. I think that this is exactly the moment why you build relationships with other people. I say this to people all the time when they come to me and say talk about wanting to join the synagogue. There's two different times that people want to join a synagogue. Sometimes people come to me, they've just lost a loved one and they need a community of support. And I say, absolutely, you can join the synagogue and we'll be there to support you. But the better time to join the synagogue, and this is the other option that I discuss with people, is when everything is good. Because then when you find yourself in a moment of crisis or a moment of mourning, that infrastructure within the synagogue of knowing people and having relationships already exists. And I think that that is exactly what's taking place in the interfaith work that you see within the Orlando community at large, that pastors and ministers and rabbis and imams have done a really excellent job of building relationships in good times. So that way we've been able to come together in the most difficult of times, like after the Pulse shooting and after other tragedies and after threats that you find against synagogues and against mosques. It doesn't work as well when the only time you get together is when things are difficult. You have to build those relationships when everything is status quo, so that way when things are difficult, you know exactly who to call. And I am proud and honored to be part of different networks within the community that exist primarily so that way we can know each other, have conversations, build those relationships so that when something happens, you know exactly who to call and you're not building a relationship in just that moment. You are calling on an existing relationship. We have, in my synagogue, gone across the street to the local mosque for an interfaith iftar every year. I just the other day was participating at St. Luke's Methodist Church in an interfaith panel commemorating Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. There is so much good interfaith work that's taking place. That's why you're seeing the support taking place now, because we already have these relationships. And so when you need to call on them, you can.
Well, Rabbi Hillel Skolnick is the rabbi with the Southwest Orlando Jewish Congregation. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Thank you.
And Jim Shipley, columnist with Heritage Florida Jewish News website. Thank you so much, Jim.
All right. Thank you very much, Matthew.
Still to come, race, politics, and the legacy of Zora Neale Hurston. We chat with Khalil Gibran Muhammad ahead of his visit to Zora Festival, and the hits may not be as hard in the Pro Bowl, but this exhibition game still delivers an economic wallop, according to Orlando's sports marketing agency. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Zora Neale Hurston is celebrated in Central Florida. Zora Festival is in its 28th year and runs this week in Eatonville with an outdoor festival of the arts next weekend. Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he'll be at the festival. He'll be talking about how America needs to do more to recognize the contribution of black Americans like Hurston to the history and culture of this country. Dr. Muhammad, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, you're going to be presenting at the Communities Conference at the Zora Festival on Friday. What's the significance of race and public policy in this historic township of Eatonville?
Well, Eatonville being, as everyone knows, the first African-American municipality, has long been a part of a larger black public sphere, a place that centers the perspectives and ideas of African-Americans, their long journey for democracy, and the contributions to the arts and culture and the literal building of this nation. And Eatonville embodies that not only in its continued significance today, but of course, one of its greatest daughters, Zora Neale Hurston.
Speaking of Zora Neale Hurston, I mean, she is, as you point out, a celebrated figure in Central Florida. I'm wondering, though, nationwide, do you think she gets the credit she's due?
No, she doesn't. And that is one of the great challenges of the 21st century, certainly something that I will reflect on in my remarks during the festival. We've not done a good job in this country expanding our civic lessons, our history lessons, paying attention to both the beauty and pageantry of our American past, but also the tragedies and challenges. And Zora Neale Hurston, like so many black writers of the past, continues to be a marginal figure in the everyday teaching of American literature in our public schools. And I'm going to keep pushing for us to do a better job of fully appreciating the multiple threads, this crazy quilt that we call American history.
She is also a fairly significant figure in bringing some context to stories about other places. She did quite a lot of field work in Haiti and informing people about those traditions.
Well, as an anthropologist, she was keenly aware of what we now take for granted, certainly in terms of academic circles, something called the African diaspora, the outpouring of black people from Africa across the Atlantic to South America, more broadly Latin America today, and of course the United States. And under her wonderful mentor, Franz Boas at Columbia University, she was part of a first generation to talk about the importance of what they called African retentions. And of course, Haiti, unlike some of the Spanish-speaking nations of the Caribbean, became an emblem, a symbol of black independence and the expressions of African diasporic cultural and spiritual traditions that continue to shape the Western Hemisphere.
Was she kind of ahead of her time in that respect?
She was most certainly ahead of her time because she was part of the founding of the very field that continues to this day to help make those connections, to build the reservoir of stories, of genealogy stories. In other words, anthropology, she was learning from essentially the founder of cultural anthropology. And in that sense, she was an absolute trailblazer. She had the unique gift, however, of translating the science of anthropology, her own personal experience, into literature and plays that were true to her personal commitments, which was to lift up the everyday in Black America.
I'm wondering, too, if you could talk a little bit about the physical legacy of a place like Eatonville and how you preserve that at the same time trying to move forward, because there has been some talk about developing Eatonville and some discussion about how to do that at the same time paying respect to the history of the place. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I must say that I have not spent a lot of time in Eatonville. I have a personal family connection. My wife was born in nearby Maitland, Florida, so I have certainly visited Eatonville, but I'm not there very often, and I'm not really attuned to the actual debate that is happening right now. I can tell you, however, that having been the director of the Schomburg Center, which recently was named a national landmark, and having gone through the process and witnessed other organizations around this nation fight for preservation as a crucial ingredient to enshrining our history in the physical landscape of this country, it is absolutely essential that whatever remains of historic Eatonville be preserved. These histories are critical for this nation to be able to reflect on its both promises, its possibilities, and also lessons, deep, hard lessons that we too often forget in the next generation. And the physical landscape is one way to do that. So preservation is absolutely critical.
We're heading into Black History Month. Just how well do you think Americans understand Black history?
Well, I can give you evidence from a study. The Southern Poverty Law Center has looked at how much we teach civil rights history over the past few years, and they come up with some pretty abysmal numbers. One report that they cite from 2011, they sampled 12,000 high school seniors in the nation, 12,000. They asked them a two-part question. What was the significance of Brown versus Board of Education, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1954, and why is it important? And when they looked at the answers, they noted that only 2% of high school seniors across America could answer both parts correctly. We don't do a good job teaching civil rights history or the Harlem Renaissance or any of the integrated ways in which the contributions of Black Americans have been indispensable not only to the wealth of the nation, to the expansion of democracy in the nation, and America's most original cultural products, its music, its jazz, its hip-hop, all of which run through the presence of black people. So we've got a lot of work to do, Matthew, and festivals such as the Zora Festival and the work that those courageous leaders in Eatonville are doing, and so many others who are unheralded are doing, is really important to getting this right going forward.
I'm wondering, too, if you might talk a little bit about some other people from American history that you think should be spotlighted. I'm thinking of, you know, the recent movie Hidden Figures, which shone a light on the engineers who were critical to the American space race back in the 60s. What other people spring to mind that you think Americans need to pay more attention to, or at least the history books should spend more time on?
Well, in some ways, I'm going to challenge the premise of the question. So Hidden Figures is amazing. And those women whose names escaped me, I did not know about them in terms of their contributions to NASA and their early space program and sending John Glenn into orbit is a terrific story. My wife, again, Stephanie Lawson from the area, was a NASA scholar. She was sent to Spelman College based on the same basic premise of diversifying the field of science and technology. The reason I'm going to challenge the premise is this really isn't about individual names so much as it is about the larger movements and contributions of many people whose names we'll never be able to remember in a catalog of history, but whose fingerprints and whose footprints on the landscape of this country have made a huge difference. So, for example, just to be very frank, if we don't study slavery as a bedrock economic system predicated on racial domination in this country, then we will not only miss the greatest history lesson for how America literally hop-skipped the rest of the world and became the wealthiest nation by the early 20th century, we will miss the relationship of that past to the very infrastructure of higher education. Nearly all of our earliest and oldest colleges and universities were literally built by the hands of the enslaved. We will not understand the way that capitalism itself was based on an Atlantic slave trade economy that wed together the Caribbean, North America, and Europe. And therefore, we're going to go into the 21st century not prepared to protect against our own tendency to forget our past and to make decisions in this country that can at times be exploitative, can at times be xenophobic, can at times reduce the humanity of others. So yes, there are many people who have told this story. Frederick Douglass comes to mind in terms of his pointing out the hypocrisies and the contradictions of America. A woman named Alice Dunbar Nelson was one of the first feminist educators in this country and spent her career in Washington, D.C. in the late 19th century, fighting for not only the visibility of black womanhood, but also fighting for just basic education for everybody. And in doing so, helped to establish that public education in this country should be an entitlement, should be a right, should not be optional, which, of course, in our day and age right now, it seems that people are questioning whether we can, in fact, educate all our children. So there's a lot to be said about the past and the contributions of black Americans to that past.
When you talk about slavery and its importance to the economy of, the young nation of America as it was developing and, as you say, kind of vaulting to the head of the pack as far as wealth, I mean, that's a hard lesson to learn or hard lesson to swallow. Do you get the sense that that is something that Americans are willing to turn their attention more fully to?
I think it would be hard, and it is hard for adults. But just like a foreign language, you don't pick up Mandarin or French or Spanish even when you're 25 years old. It's hard to do. You start teaching it at 5 years old. You start teaching it in preschool. You just start with the basic idea that our history and our country is complicated, rather than a simple linear progression from a past to a present, from the Enlightenment ideals of the founders to the heroism of Abraham Lincoln to the soaring rhetoric of Martin Luther King. I mean, in a way, that's kind of how we teach American history. And we've been moving in the wrong direction, to be frank, even in the last few years. Texas has decided that the history books need to be simpler, that children need to feel better about America's history, so a little bit less civil rights is probably better for them. My point being that if we teach it young, and then children will come to understand that complexity, and they will come to embody the very values of equality and justice that we profess but we see too often are not fully realized. I'll give you one very practical example. My wife is an elected member of our local school board in South Orange, New Jersey. I spend a lot of time as a historian helping her and the school district think through their social studies curriculum. And one thing that has come to our attention is that our children, I have children who've started in this school district from first grade, and now I have a junior in high school. They read something about the Holocaust every year, some form of fiction, short story, poetry, memoir, and they don't do the same with slavery. So why is it that in this town and in America more generally, we can talk about man's inhumanity to man when it happened elsewhere, but we can't talk about it in our own country? And it's not a surprise that we see the kind of racial divisions and polarization, and dare I say, in some pockets of America, both black and white American, levels of ignorance and historical illiteracy that are shameful to us. We as a nation should be shameful of the level of or lack of understanding about basic facts in this country and in our present that pass as a sophisticated, civilized nation. So we have a lot of work to do in how we prepare our children for the full burdens and responsibilities of citizenship going forward.
I want to just ask, too, about something you wrote in the New York Times recently. You wrote that, quote, "We now live in a post-assimilation America," and you were talking about how the fact that we had the first black president of the United States kind of showed that that is not the be-all and end-all. That's not the end of the story. I'm wondering what you thought when Barack Obama was elected president. Like, how did you see that playing out over the course of his presidency?
Well, I was incredibly proud. You know, you don't get a whole lot of people who are your president, so it's not like the suite of options is always unlimited. We have a two-party system, and that constrains the possibilities for presidential leadership. And in Barack Obama, I saw an incredibly gifted, talented, a thoughtful, committed, passionate person, and I was proud of him to become president. And in his own biography, particularly for his commitment to working in my hometown of Chicago for the least of these and on behalf of the least of these, there was very little in his presentation of self or his prescriptions for the future that gave me reason to be concerned about how he would lead and govern this nation. But I must say that the price that he paid for gaining the presidency did limit his capacity and willingness to speak as truthfully about the country that he actually inherited than the one that we all aspire to. And I have come to terms with the fact that for the first in that position, for the first black president, there likely was little else he could have done. But I am now hopeful that we will no longer look to the simple fact of being black in office as a sufficient solution to the structural challenges and the institutional biases that plague too much of America, and that we will expect of those future leaders, whether they are black or Latino or Asian or the first woman, to speak directly to those challenges rather than the symbolic importance of the achievement in and of itself.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He'll be speaking at the Zora Festival on Friday. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks very much, Matthew, for having me.
Still to come, the Pro Bowl hits town, and Florida Citrus Sports CEO Steve Hogan says it shows how Orlando's serious about sports. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In just over a week, some of the best football players in the country will gather at Orlando's Camping World Stadium for the Pro Bowl. The two teams are picked by NFL fans who vote for the best players from the AFC and the NFC. It's the first time the Pro Bowl has been played in Orlando, which won the exhibition game away from Hawaii. Steve Hogan is the chief executive of Florida Citrus Sports, which lobbied to bring the game to Orlando. Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Well, put this in context for us. How big a deal is the Pro Bowl for football fans?
We think it's a big deal. I mean, anytime you could partner with the NFL, one of the world's most popular leagues, and have that in our community, a community that doesn't have an NFL tenant or NFL relationship, we think is a big deal. And I think from a quality of life standpoint, an economic impact standpoint, I think maybe even most importantly, just a marketing standpoint and telling people that there's more here than just tourism, and Orlando's a great place to live, work, and play.
So this is a chance for fans of the NFL to see some real stars, only if their team isn't in the Super Bowl. Who are the players on the roster this year that are going to draw the biggest crowds or that you think people would really want to see?
Well, you know, I think you think of a lot of the regulars in terms of the Odell Beckhams of the world and Josh Normans and the various, you know, players that are talked about, Antonio Brown and people like that. But I get excited. You know, there's going to be 22 players this year's NFL Pro Bowl roster that have appeared in Orlando Bowl games in the past. So I think that's pretty cool, too. And I'm really excited to see the new rookies like Dak Prescott and Ezekiel Elliott and those guys come here and see them live. They've had a heck of a season so far.
Is it kind of, for the fans' point of view, or from the fans' point of view, is this kind of like a chance to see some live football, some really top-class athletes for folks who just obviously can't go to the Super Bowl?
I do. I think, you know, any time that you can put a collection of the best athletes on the planet in this sport and some of the more recognizable names all on one field. I mean, anytime you see an NFL regular season game, you see some stars, you see some players. But in this case, you're seeing all of these great names, all these great talents on a field at the same time running around. And I think really knocking around town all week long. You can go to the practices free of charge and see them up close. Game night's going to be unbelievably special. So, yeah, I think from that standpoint, just the sheer collection of talent is what makes this so fun.
Talk to me about the practices then. Do you have to buy tickets for those, or is it free?
Practices are open and free to the fan out at Disney's Wild World of Sports. They start on Wednesday. Fans do need to download a fan mobile app to access that and many of the other events. I mean, there's literally probably 50 or so events going on in town all week long. And so you can go look at all that on ProBowl.com and download that fan mobile pass and enjoy all of it.
Do a lot of the folks who are going to go to the game, do they show up early to catch some of that action before the Pro Bowl kicks off?
Absolutely. You know, and there's a lot of reasons why people would come to town. Some are following their kids that might be participating in the punt, pass, and kick championships or the NFL Youth Flag National Championship games that'll be participating here, the Women's Tackle Football Championship games. There is so much going on. The USA Football National Convention will be hosted here as part of Pro Bowl week as well. So I think there's a lot of fans. Even if you're not in a participation event like that, just going to Fan Zone and doing all the interactives all those days and getting to see these players up close and personal at practice drives a lot of the people into the market several days in advance.
So there is a whole suite of activities around the Pro Bowl. It's not just a one-off. It's kind of a smorgasbord of football.
It really is. And you know, you think about some of the great entertainers, and you think all the various personalities. There'll be live radio remotes on site at Disney Springs. There's an EA, I mean, really the best players of Madden NFL football on EA Sports will be competing in a Madden Ultimate Team tournament here as well. So interactively, there's just so much going on that you don't normally have with a typical one-off game on a weekend for one night that gives you really a week of sports and entertainment.
So, Steve Hogan, talk to me a little bit about the economic impact of this. $25 million, I think, for Hawaii when it hosted the Pro Bowl. That was the estimate. How big of an impact is this to Orlando?
Well, I think, you know, you feel a lot better about the accessibility of Orlando, which was one of the attractions here, I think. Two-thirds of the NFL teams, I think, could get here relatively easily. They actually fall in a, you know, traditional tourism destinations for Orlando east of the Mississippi River. Many of the teams are drivable in the southeast, so we think that that only bodes well for our economic impact number being ahead of the Hawaii's. But even if it was only $25 million, we'll take it. You know, I think it's really more the $200 million plus in exposure value that is estimated for hosting this event that we're equally as excited about.
And when you talk about the things that are going on around the Pro Bowl, I mean, does that sort of spread the impact if folks are showing up a little bit earlier, spending a few more days in a hotel, maybe taking in some other stuff besides the football?
I think you're exactly right, and that's, I think, the real hidden gem here. When we got into bidding and competing for this event, you know, in 30-plus years in Hawaii, it largely, there were other events going on in Hawaii and certainly the game itself. But I think what has happened here in year one in Orlando is beyond what everybody's wildest dreams were. I mean, the intent was to make this a family affair, to celebrate the sport at all levels. and really kind of integrate a multitude of other experiences into Pro Bowl week and invest in it here in Orlando. And that's exactly what's happened. So I think that that exponential growth of nationally televised, you got the Skills Challenge nationally televised, you've now got all these other events, the women's matchup I mentioned, the NFL flag punt, pass and kick, Don Shula Award, all these other things going on are things that hadn't traditionally been happening in Pro Bowl week in Hawaii. So we think that the, you know, that only bodes well for us here in Central Florida in terms of what this event will mean to us economically and then in impression exposure wise.
Now, this isn't the first time the Pro Bowl has been held in Florida, right? I think it was in Miami before.
It was. The only other two times that the Pro Bowl was not in Hawaii was in Miami and in Phoenix, but those were coupled with the NFL Super Bowl. So when you put them in a Super Bowl city, they're kind of a part of that infrastructure, and in my opinion, at least, become almost a one-night event of that week, you know, and it's really kind of all this infrastructure there for a Super Bowl. And then you're kind of plopping this game and practices and stuff in the midst of all that impact that's already there. By doing what you're doing in Orlando, and what's unique is it's a standalone event, a standalone region, and you now have It Is The Show, and all these other events that have been added are a part of that activity and not really kind of coupled with the Super Bowl infrastructure that would normally be in place.
Can you tell me when the Pro Bowl was in Miami?
You know, I think it was in the 2010 range. Is when it was there, and I think 2015, most recently, it was in Phoenix.
So looking back to 2010, I mean, has anything changed as far as the sophistication of the way these events are put on and promoted and the kind of activities you have going on around the event?
No doubt. I think that when you look at the amount of events, and again, the real sincere commitment by the NFL to make this a celebration of the sport of football, from children through seniors, you know, and just the family nature of many of these things that have been plugged into Pro Bowl week are totally unlike any other Pro Bowl that's probably been hosted in recent memory. So I think this is a special brand new start for the way that they want to elevate the Pro Bowl, and they're doing it here in Central Florida.
There has been, I guess, some controversy around the NFL in recent years. I mean, is the Pro Bowl a little different? Is the style of the game different, or just the way it is kind of pitched more as a family event?
Well, I think it's totally different in terms of how it's being pitched and how it's being partnered with these other events. But they have gone back to what is the more fan-friendly, I think, traditional AFC against NFC team matchup. So in Canada, they tried a few years where it was a draft format and you would be drafting players, kind of a fantasy football type style. Now it's actually NFC players against AFC players, two definitive kind of teams, and I think that's a change. The Skills Challenge has come back now, which many years ago there were elements of a Skills Challenge that were very popular. So this is the first year that they're coming back with that. And you look at this epic dodgeball, you look at some of the hands and skills challenges that'll be there, the power relay. These are going to be things that fans are just going to eat up, not only locally, but nationally on television.
What about the players? How do they feel about the Pro Bowl?
Well, I don't know if we know yet. You know, we certainly hope when they go home, after they've come and experienced this community and the Orlando community, and hopefully we'll roll out the red carpet, they'll have a fantastic hotel experience. Many of them now, which is new, they get to bring one of the coaches in their life, whether it was Pop Warner or high school or college, that was very important to them. They get to bring them for a free Pro Bowl week experience along with the player themselves. We hope that, you know, with all the attractions and the things our families are going to get to do and the game and the stadium and the way that the town sets up will be something that maybe they didn't expect. And that's our job. And I hope when they leave, they say, you know what, that might have been one of the best Pro Bowls they've ever had.
And I imagine a lot of the players would have come to Orlando anyway. Isn't it kind of a tradition if you win the Super Bowl, you go to Disney World?
Well, I think it certainly has been for the MVP. You know, the MVP typically would say, I get to go to, you know, I'm going to Disney World and going to ride in the parade. But now that, you know, so many more people get to enjoy that at this level, these world-class players, that maybe will be the first time they've all been treated to this. Usually it's one or two folks that are traditionally the MVPs from the Super Bowl.
Do you think, Steve Hogan, that Orlando's relationship to the game of football is changing? And does this sort of signify a shift in the importance of football in this city?
I do. I think, you know, we've had a lot of success in the postseason with college football. We have a brand new kickoff game. College football has been pretty solidified in this market for the last, you know, 70 years, basically. You know, this new relationship with the NFL, we've had some preseason games, But to have one of their signature events in your community, and I think just go further into all the other events and activities Orlando's now hosting, when you look at international soccer matches, Copa, all these other things, I think what the NFL signifies and the NFL Pro Bowl signifies is that Orlando maybe is open for business now in a different way. People can pay attention to Orlando in a way that maybe they didn't appreciate in the past, from the venues to the attractions to the airports to the weather to the way that corporate business supports things, so the way that our political infrastructure supports things. That's what I think it means most, is that it's a new day for doing business in this market.
Orange County put up quite a bit of money to bring this game here too, $3 million, I think. So there is quite a lot riding on the success of the event. Do you have some information on how sales are going as far as selling tickets to the game?
Yeah, sales are going great, actually. I think we're now within the last few thousand tickets that'll be available. I feel really good about, you know, where the market is and that this game has the opportunity to sell out, and that was always our goal. So we're very pleasantly surprised and appreciative of the support that this game already has demonstrated, and I think on game night we're going to look awesome on TV.
Remind me what the capacity is for the game?
Yeah, we've set the stadium up for right at about 61,000 seats.
So that's a lot of people coming in from outside. I guess I wonder too, Steve Hogan, if you have some idea on how many folks are coming from out of state to see this.
I don't know if we know the final metric on that yet. You know, and again, we touted the economic impact of this event where it was in Hawaii. So we weren't aggressive in any way, shape, or form. We felt like it was a no-brainer that we could deliver that kind of an impact. I certainly believe we'll exceed that. We won't know yet until we kind of get through the event and break down the zip codes for ticket purchases and all to get a better feel for where we were out of market, in market. I do know for our bowl games and for college football, we've traditionally been in the 60 to 65% range in terms of out-of-market attendees at our games. And so, you know, we feel really good about where this is going to be.
And was it a tough sell for Orange County commissioners, or were they on board from the get-go as far as putting that money up to bring the game here?
No, you know, I really honestly was pleasantly surprised that everybody seemed to be on board from day one. I mean, they viewed this as an opportunity, not only, again, I keep saying it, economically, it's important, but I think they viewed it as a way, is this a statement about what kind of community we have now and the way that we can host events and we can host any event? And I think they understood and appreciated, you know, the brand message that partnering with the NFL and the NFL Pro Bowl brought to our community. So I was pleasantly surprised that everywhere we went, people said, what do we need to do? Tell us how we can help. Let's go get this thing.
Just finally, Steve Hogan, do you have to lobby again for the next game, or is this a multi-year contract? How does that work?
You know, the intention is that this be a two-year partnership with a third-year option. And so we want to work very hard in this community to see that this met every test we had for it locally and that the NFL has for it, so that this can be here much longer than that. But it was originally kind of a three-year outlook with 2 years with a third-year option.
Steve Hogan is the Chief Executive Officer of Florida Citrus Sports, getting ready to host the Pro Bowl in Orlando on the 27th of January. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, appreciate your time.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Talia Blake. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. You can find this show and previous episodes on our website, wmfe.org/intersection, or wherever you download your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.